It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Israel's leader denounces an Iranian nuclear agreement under negotiation as a bad deal. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sought to make his case against a nuclear agreement being negotiated with Iran. Speaking Tuesday before a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress, the Israeli leader summarized his two major concerns.
This deal has two major concessions. One, leaving Iran with a vast nuclear program. And two, lifting the restrictions on that program in about a decade. That's why this deal is so bad.
He says the talks underway between Iran and the so-called P5 plus one nations would guarantee Tehran would get nuclear weapons, a threat to the Middle East and the world. President Obama, who didn't attend the speech, said there was nothing new in the remarks.
On the core issue, which is how do we prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, the Prime Minister didn't offer any viable alternatives.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iran's foreign minister met in Switzerland Tuesday for a second day to discuss the Iranian program. The U.N. Security Council Tuesday unanimously adopted a resolution creating a system to impose sanctions on those blocking peace in South Sudan. Samantha Power is the U.S. U.N. ambassador.
While various papers have been signed, partial agreements entered into, promises made, assurances delivered, the situation has only worsened for the people of the UN's newest country.
The U.S. draft resolution doesn't single out South Sudanese President Salva Kiir or rebel leader Riek Machar by name, although it does refer to leaders of any entity. Punishments would include an arms embargo, global travel ban, and asset freezes. The rival South Sudanese leaders met Tuesday in Addis Ababa ahead of a March 5 deadline set by a regional bloc mediating the talks. This is VOA News. An Iraqi coalition is battling its way toward Tikrit for a third day, facing Islamic State snipers and roadside bombs. With an estimated 30,000 fighters pressing toward the rebel-held city, the offensive is Iraq's largest to date in an effort to regain control of territory lost to the militants last year. A victory would be a geographic stepping stone for Iraqi forces to approach Iraq's second biggest city, Mosul. The heads of the three West African countries hit hardest by the Ebola epidemic, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, met in Brussels Tuesday asking for donor help in repairing the damage to their economies caused by the deadly virus that has killed some 9,600 people. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf called for a post-war-style Marshall Plan to re-help build the country's economies. Ernest Bai Koroma is president of Sierra Leone.
The priorities now is one, getting to a resilient zero, two, rebuilding our health sector, three, getting our kids to school, and four, providing social protection for the most vulnerable and sustaining recovery from Ebola through expanding our fiscal space, restoring agricultural activities, and supporting the private sector.
Mr. Koroma said victory is within sight, but cautioned against complacency. While overall numbers of cases have declined, there has been an increase in parts of Sierra Leone. The country's vice president has placed himself in voluntary quarantine after a bodyguard died of Ebola complications last week. Two Australian drug smugglers in Indonesia were taken from their Bali prison Wednesday to an island where they're to be executed. Andrew Chan and Myuran Sukumaran, who spent the past decade behind bars, were accompanied by Rahim Agbaje Salami of Nigeria and a 30-year-old Philippine national Mary Jane Fiesta Veloso. All four expected to face the firing squad in coming days. Five other foreigners, two Nigerians and a man each from Brazil, France, and Ghana, are also to be executed on the prison island off Indonesia's main island of Java. A Libyan security official says Islamic militants seized two oil fields Tuesday ahead of more UN peace talks. The official said rebel fighters took over the Bahi and Mabruk fields after Libyan security forces tasked with guarding the fields retreated. Ivory Coast goalkeeper Boubacar Kopa Berry, who became a national hero scoring the decisive penalty kick in the Africa Cup of Nations final Tuesday, announced his retirement from international sport at age 35. Berry only played in the final after first-string goalie Sylvain Gbohu was injured in the semifinal match. He also played for the Belgian squad Lokeren. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Security Council approves a framework for sanctions on individuals obstructing peace in South Sudan's civil war.
Today in South Sudan, quite literally, a young generation's future is being held ransom by political actors who, despite all costs, refuse to compromise. This cannot continue, and those who frustrate peace must begin to pay the price.
Samantha Power is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. We'll get reactions from South Sudan government and rebel officials meeting in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. We'll also get an update on the peace talks in Ethiopia, and ICC appeals judges rule on reparations for victims in the case of Congolese rebel leader Thomas Lubanga.
The appeals chamber therefore finds that the trial chamber erred in holding that reparations award should be formulated and implemented to include victims of sexual and gender-based violence and amends the impunity system.
An ICC appeals court judge in The Hague on Tuesday's ruling, Kenya's president burns 15 tons of ivory tusks. Cameroon and Chad soldiers work together to combat Boko Haram. And there's a new push to ramp so-called green jobs in Africa. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The UN Security Council has taken the first step towards sanctioning spoilers to the peace process in South Sudan. In a unanimous vote, the 15-nation council decided on Tuesday to establish the legal framework required for sanctioning individuals and entities. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir explains.
After months of threatening to go the sanctions route, the Security Council adopted a resolution that envisions a travel ban, asset freeze, and possibly an arms embargo against individuals and entities that are preventing an end to the 15 months of violence that has killed thousands in South Sudan and displaced 2 million people. The resolution also sets up a panel of experts who will gather information on the flow of weapons to those undermining the peace process and violating human rights. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power, whose delegation drafted the resolution, said the measure is intended to support regional group IGAD's mediation efforts between the parties of President Salva Kiir and his political rival Riek Machar.
Today in South Sudan, quite literally, a young generation's future is being held ransom by political actors who, despite all costs, refuse to compromise. This cannot continue, and those who frustrate peace must begin to pay the price.
While the resolution does not go so far as to designate names for sanctions, political leaders have been put on notice. The two parties have agreed to an IGAD deadline of March 5th for finalizing a peace deal. China's ambassador, Liu Zhiyi, said by adopting the resolution now, the council is sending a united message to urge a breakthrough in the negotiations. He's heard here through a translator.
China sincerely hopes that the two negotiating parties will, as soon as possible, reach a compromise on the pending issues in order to take a crucial step in restoring peace and stability to South Sudan, as it is in the fundamental and long-term interests of the country and people of South Sudan.
China has extensive investments in South Sudan, especially in its oil sector, which has been targeted in recent fighting. While China was supportive of the resolution, Russia's representative said their vote in favor was not a sign of unconditional support, and he repeated Moscow's position that sanctions are not an effective means for settling conflicts. South Sudan's envoy, Francis Dang, echoed this position. He said a sustainable solution to the crisis would not be found through sanctions and warned against targeting South Sudan's leadership, saying it would be counterproductive in the pursuit of peace. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
At the South Sudan peace talks in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, government spokesman Michael Makui downplayed Tuesday's UN Security Council approval of a framework for sanctions on individuals impeding progress towards peace in South Sudan.
Read the statement correctly. It doesn't say that it has passed sanctions. It is saying it has decided to set up a committee to first enumerate who are those to be sanctioned and thereafter organize it. Read the resolutions correctly. Don't misinform people.
South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makui speaking in Addis Ababa.
Pyo Kang Chol, a spokesman for rebels loyal to former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar, also reacted to the UN Security Council's approval of a framework for sanctions on individuals obstructing the peace process.
We believe that you will not bring peace because you sanction people. But instead, we expect them to demand the release and the publishing of the Commission of Inquiry report, which is very important when they are, you know, imposing sanction. All in all, we are not worried by it, and we are also waiting to see what will it transpire. Will it bring peace or not? That is not our worry. But our worry is that we want them to demand for the release of the report because we believe it's very important, and we believe that it will help in accountability and holding individual responsible for their act.
Pyo Kang Chol is the spokesman for rebels loyal to former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar. He was speaking to John Tanza of VOA's Sudan in Focus program. The two key principals in the South Sudan conflict, President Salva Kiir and rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar, held their first round of talks yesterday in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Government spokesman Michael Makui says the two parties did not agree on anything.
The principals started their talk on the federal system of governance, and there was a disagreement over it. We also started negotiating on the question of the two armies and the transitional security arrangements, and the two parties did not agree on the question of the two armies during the pre-transitional and the transitional period. So the parties agreed to slip over this. And by tomorrow at 10, we will continue to negotiate, hoping that tonight God will visit us and give us the necessary wisdom to enable us to agree and bring peace to South Sudan.
That was South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makui speaking in Addis Ababa with John Tanza of VOA's Sudan in Focus program. Rebel spokesman Pyo Kang Chol said the two sides discussed the question of what to do with the two armies during the transitional and pre-transitional period, but failed to reach an agreement.
We did not agree on any issue, but we believe that there was a progress because the two leaders were able to sit face-to-face and discuss issues. We discussed the status of the army forces, which we did not finish, and we believe we will continue from there tomorrow. On our side, even if we are told to sit all night, as long as it's for peace in South Sudan, we will do so. We came here open-minded, ready to negotiate, and ready to meet the deadline.
Pyo Kang Chol is the spokesman for rebels loyal to former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar. He was speaking to John Tanza of VOA's Sudan in Focus program. In a ruling closely watched by human rights groups, appeals judges at the Hague-based International Criminal Court have set out the scope of reparations for victims of Congolese World War Thomas Lubanga, who is serving a prison sentence for war crimes. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Good morning. The court is in session. Would the court officer please call the case?
The appeals judges at the International Criminal Court ruled on a series of measures on behalf of victims of ex-Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga. They said reparations programs should include measures to integrate former child soldiers under his command back into the community. And they said the original trial chamber had made a mistake in ruling that Lubanga should not be held liable for reparations because he was indigent. But when it came to reparations for gender-based violence, the appeals judges offered a narrower ruling.
The appeals chamber considers that sexual and gender-based violence cannot be defined as a harm resulting from the crimes for which Mr. Lubanga was convicted. The appeals chamber therefore finds that the trial chamber erred in holding that reparations award should be formulated and implemented to include victims of sexual and gender-based violence and amends the impunity system.
54-year-old Lubanga was sentenced in 2012 to 14 years in prison for war crimes, specifically for using child soldiers in fighting in Northeast Democratic Republic of Congo's Ituri region in 2002 and 2003. In December, the ICC's appeals court upheld the ruling, closing the court's first case. Both Lubanga and the victim's representative had also appealed the 2012 decision on victims' reparations. Monday's ruling brings that appeal to a close. Rights groups like Paris-based FIDH or International Federation for Human Rights have been pushing for a broad interpretation of victims' reparations that would include things like campaigns to limit stigmatization of victims and educational programs. FIDH's representative at the ICC, Carrie Comer, said the group was still studying Monday's ruling, but she welcomed some aspects of it.
The chamber also reinforced that both direct and indirect victims who suffered harm from the crimes for which Mr. Lubanga was convicted are eligible for reparations. But obviously excluding victims of sexual and gender-based crimes is a setback.
Last year, the ICC's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, announced a new policy to attack sexual and gender-based violence. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Today's Wednesday, March 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Kenya burned 15 tons of elephant tusk on Tuesday in a symbolic gesture against the illicit ivory trade. As VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports, the government has promised to destroy all of its remaining ivory stocks as it stepped up a fight against poaching.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta lowered a burning torch to a three-tiered pile of ivory tusks, sending flames and smoke swirling high into the air above Nairobi National Park. Speaking at the event, which also marked World Wildlife Day, Mr. Kenyatta said the burning represents Kenya's commitment to stopping the ivory trade.
African countries are concerned about the scale and rate of the new threat to our endangered wildlife species. We are committed to combating the menace robustly and persistently until we dismantle the entire vile economy.
Conservationists say Africa loses more than 20,000 elephants each year to illegal poaching, and that the animals could go extinct by the middle of the century if the trend continues. Ivory trafficking has been driven mostly by demand from Asian consumers who use the material to make jewelry and ornaments. Kenya first burned some of its ivory stocks in 1989 and held another public burn in 2011. Mr. Kenyatta said Kenya plans to eliminate all of its remaining ivory stocks.
In order to underline our determination to eradicate poaching, my government shall burn the rest of the stockpile that we have within this year.
Kenya Wildlife Service spokesman Paul Udoto said the act of burning ivory is meant to send a message to the world about the value of wildlife.
We are saying what we have here is priceless. That's the reason we are setting it on fire. Because if it had value, we would have required this money to do our conservation work. But we are saying we place value on our elephants in their wild environment.
China last month instituted a one-year ban on imports of ivory carvings. However, the moratorium does not address the domestic trade within China, which conservationists say fuels demand and provides a cover for illicit international trafficking. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
Close to 7,000 soldiers from Cameroon and Chad have taken positions on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, ready to combat Boko Haram Islamic extremists. The soldiers, however, are finding it difficult operating across the border into Nigerian territory, where they say the insurgents have planted mines. Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited Cameroon's northern border and reports.
Chadian and Cameroonian soldiers sing during a joint training session in Fotokol on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria's Borno State, stronghold of the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. It is from Fotokol that Chadian soldiers organize attacks on Nigerian towns seized by Boko Haram and assist Cameroon in protecting its territory from militants fighting to create an Islamist caliphate. Cameroonian-born Captain Bertus Kwenny, who is supervising the training session, says it is imperative for forces to know each other and prevent their enemy Boko Haram from penetrating.
Les forces amies tchadiennes qui avaient pris place
en avant de nos positions.
He says in the beginning, Boko Haram fighters gained access to Cameroon's territory because of the confusion they had identifying Chadian soldiers. He adds that they, however, succeeded to push back the insurgents. The soldiers take turns to protect the bridge on the Elbeid River that separates Fotokol from the Nigerian town of Gambaru. Boko Haram fighters occupied the town for several months before Chadian soldiers chased the insurgents out early last month. The soldiers say thousands of people died. Richard T. is a Cameroon soldier who was part of the operation to save Gambaru from the insurgents. He says they avoided killing civilians because they know how to identify Boko Haram fighters.
They have the way they dress, and they move always in a group. They are well armed. They have rockets. They have machine guns. The relationship we have with the population, Kirawa, Cameroon, they do collaborate with us in the sense that if there's any enemy in the quarter, they do alert us.
Captain Ibrahim Janko of the Cameroon military says Boko Haram fighters seem not to be disturbed by the huge presence of Chadian and Cameroonian troops in the border area. He says the insurgents come through the mountain to target Kolofata, which hosts one of their main bases.
When they decide to come and attack Kolofata, they will gather off their means, all their tanks, all their machine guns and everything, and come because they know it's the headquarter. And nobody can imagine the day, the date, and the hour of attack, because they're always surprised when they come to attack Kolofata.
Cameroon has received training and equipment from the United States and Russia to detect and destroy the mines. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kolofata, Northern Cameroon.
There's a current push in Africa to ramp up so-called green jobs or employment opportunities that address environmental challenges such as minimizing waste and adapting to climate change. How to increase these jobs is one issue being addressed at the African Ministerial Conference on the Environment taking place in Cairo this week. Mustafa Kamal Gee, a policy specialist for green jobs at the International Labour Organization, explains to Ricky Shryak from the conference why more green jobs could benefit Africa.
You know, this notion of green jobs really means employment in various economic sectors, in agriculture, industry, in the services, which contribute to addressing environmental challenges. For example, minimizing waste and pollution, helping adapt to climate change, promoting material and energy efficiency. So in that sense, many African countries have been promoting green jobs directly or indirectly. And I can give a few examples. South Africa has been implementing what they call the Working For programs. So this includes programs called Working For Water, Working For Energy, Working For Forest. And these are programs that are meant to create employment opportunities for low-skilled workers, but mostly in areas that contribute to managing natural resources. We have reports that in the Working for Water program, around 400,000 work opportunities have been created in South Africa.
What are the main challenges to providing green jobs in sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, I think one of the challenges is really a perception issue. There are many, not many, perhaps some, who still believe that there is a trade-off between environmental action, environmental conservation and management on the one hand, and employment creation and economic growth in general. That if you put an ambitious environmental agenda, that slows your economic growth and opportunities to create jobs. So part of our work in the ILO has been to argue and provide evidence to the contrary, and to demonstrate that environmental actions can indeed be an opportunity to create additional jobs and secure existing jobs. So that work on really working with countries to undertake ex ante assessments of where opportunities for job creation could be for their economies. We have been doing it through green job assessments. We have also been working closely with the UN Environment Programme on green economy assessments that show countries where they may have opportunity for job creation. The second major challenge that I see is the skills challenge. So countries find in Senegal, for example, that there is a large potential for clean energy generation. But these countries often lack the technical capabilities, human skills.
Mustafa Kamal Gueye is a policy specialist for green jobs at the International Labour Organization. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Cairo, Egypt. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with cricket. South Africa outclassed Ireland by 201 runs at the Cricket World Cup in Brisbane, Australia on Tuesday. In athletics, South Africa's Shanghai Marathon champion, Stephen Mukoka, won the South Africa 10-kilometer championships in 29 minutes and 38 seconds in the capital, Tshwane, on Saturday. He then traveled 700 kilometers by road and won the 10 kilometers at the Durban City Marathon in a world-class time of 28 minutes and 33 seconds on Sunday. Mukoka says it's all part of training for the World Cross-Country Championships in China later this month.
The most important thing was my fitness level. I think it's on track for the next 3 weeks. I think if I can focus more on my speed, because I was doing too much of my mileage, so now I'm going to focus on speed. That's why my coach brought us here on the tire track, so that we can do the sharpening part for the World Cross Country.
World Cross Country has been dominated by the East Africans, but last time you did break into that top 20. What is your thinking in terms of going towards the World Cross Country Championships?
Competing with East Africans in normal races, I mean, if you can find them in a league of cross country or on a road race or on a track meeting, it's always easy to break them. But when you go to championships, those guys, they go to camps, and then when you are in a camp, camping with strong guys, you can't motivate it. And then normally when you find them at the championships, they are very strong. I mean, you can beat a guy today, and then, but when you get to championship, he's strong. But I mean, that's what we are looking forward to. I mean, the most important thing is the teamwork. I'm very excited this time because all the guys that are going, I mean, most of the guys that are running 12 kilometers are my training partner. So if we can be able to work together here training, push each other, but maybe if our fitness level is more or less the same, I mean, when we get there, if we can cheer each other and then fight, I mean, represent the country well, we can be able to, I mean, fight them. But the main important goal for myself is that, I mean, the last time I went to World Cross Country, I finished 15th. She's the fastest ever run by a South African. And then I'm very excited now because the very same guy who ran or who was 15th at some point at Cross Country will be there at the World Championship. So, I mean, if he was not old, I would say it's a battle between me and him to see who can break that. But I'll be happy if I break that in his presence.
That was Stephen Mukoka, South Africa's Shanghai Marathon champion, speaking in the South African capital, Tshwane. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Chadian forces in the northeastern Nigerian town of Dikwa say they have recaptured the town from Boko Haram militants. The military reported that 34 soldiers were injured in the effort to liberate the town, which had been under the control of Boko Haram for weeks. Soldiers were going street to street looking for remaining militants who had not yet fled. A Libyan security official says Islamic militants seized two oil fields Tuesday, just ahead of more UN peace talks. The official said rebel fighters took over the Bahi and Mambruk fields after Libyan security forces tasked with guarding the fields retreated. And that's it for this Wednesday, March 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Barton, Washington, saying have a nice day.
Take your peek, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, we'll talk about the fighting in South Sudan. African leaders meeting in Addis Ababa say stop the conflict or face sanctions. That's next, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA. On Africa News Tonight,
we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.